Welcome to the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, where every death had a life and every life had a story. My name is Jenny Johnson.
Hello, and I'm Diane Hartshorn.
And today we are joined by three very special guests. I think this is the first time we've ever had three guests. So there'll be five of us here today. They all hail from Thibodaux, Louisiana, and they are going to be talking about St. John's Historic Cemetery with us today. And St. John's Historic Cemetery is on the National Register of Historic Places. And I was looking at the pictures on the website, and it's a gorgeous little cemetery that's surrounded by great big oak trees. And there's a lot of above ground tombs and crypts and things. And it's absolutely gorgeous to look at. So we are very excited to have the three of you here with us today to give us more of an insight into your cemetery. So I will start. We have David Plater, who is the chairman of the board for the Cemetery Association. We also have John Dennis, who is a board member. And lastly, we have Theodore Pierre, who is a mason, and he has been helping to restore the headstones and other monuments within the cemetery. So welcome all three of you.
Thank you all for having us.
This is very, very exciting. So we thought we'd start with David. David is going to give us sort of a brief rundown of the history of the cemetery and how it's connected to a St. John's Episcopal Church. And then we will go from there with our storytelling.
Thank you very much, Jenny. The cemetery was founded when the church was founded in 1843. The whole city block on which the church and the cemetery are located was donated by a plantation owner who owned the property where the church is. And he was a native of the Natchez area. Thibodaux was being settled by many people from the other parts of the South in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. And he had come from Natchez with his new bride, and she had been given this large plantation by her stepfather. So they settled nearby, and within 10 or 12 years, he decided to subdivide part of his plantation, which was adjacent to the old town of Thibodaux. So being an Episcopalian, his name was George S. Guyon. Guyon donated to the Diocese of Louisiana the entire block, and was a spearhead in the building of the church and hiring the first priest, who happened to be named Leonidas Polk, P-O-L-K. He was a native of North Carolina who had lived in Tennessee, and he was the bishop of Louisiana at that time, but living near Thibodaux, where he and his wife had a sugarcane plantation. And he would go around the state and other states. He was in charge of a multi-state area. And he knew that Thibodaux was becoming more and more Protestant in nature, and it needed a Protestant church. So he engineered the construction of the church, and at the same time established and mapped the cemetery. Its first burials are in 1843, when the church construction began, and they continued slowly to be slow burials throughout the 1840s. The church, the cemetery was treeless, basically, in its beginnings. And people who were buried there tended to be very traditional, very conservative in the tombs that they had constructed for them, or the families constructed. But they many of them followed a Greek revival style of architecture, which the church also had, somewhat in a temple form, for example. And you can see that in the photographs in the website.
Yes, and we will be sure to have a link to that for our listeners. Okay.
So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what's going on. My cohorts will add to it if they wish. And I think we're all going to interrupt each other as we go along here.
No problem. So one of the things I found fascinating in reading about the cemetery and looking at the pictures that are on the website is the amount of oak trees that are in and around this cemetery. And John, I think you were going to tell us a little bit more about those trees.
Yeah, so kind of going with what David was saying is that the church was established in the 1840s, 1843, 1844, one of the oldest Episcopal churches west of the Mississippi. And prior to when the church was originally built, there weren't as many oak trees as there are now. Right now, today, we had the church, I want to say maybe 10 years ago or so, had like a tree inventory done just to do an assessment of the trees, the health of the trees, what are we dealing with, how are they impacting the property of the cemetery and the graves, because that's part of the iconic nature of the church itself is the church, but then also the grounds. The grounds cover approximately, the church grounds, entire church grounds, covers approximately 3 acres. And I guess I should give my background real quick. I'm born and raised here in Thibodaux. And so I've gone to this church my whole life and been gone from Louisiana for about 20 years and just came back last year. And so it's kind of nice to be back in this area. And I've gotten an appreciation for the church, for St. John's, being gone from it for so long and coming back and seeing what a neat little church it is to preserve. And so the grounds, it's about 3 acres of land that the entire church and the cemetery is on. Now the cemetery itself covers a little over 2 acres of those 3 acres of land. So over 2/3 of the area is devoted to the cemetery. So, I mean, it's a large portion of the property. And in those 2/3 of the cemetery of the lands, there's about 40 live oaks that are present on the property. And those oak trees, as David said, the church was established or started being constructed in the 1840s. The oak trees, based on archival records that we've got, were planted in the 1850s, 1855, 1856, somewhere around there, by one of the priests. I think his name is Thomas Trader, T-R-A-D-E-R. And so those trees really are about 165, 166 years old.
That's amazing.
And those are not the oldest oak trees in the parish, in Lafourche Parish. And, oak trees are a vital part of South Louisiana because they, you know, not only are they beautiful trees, but they're great shade trees and they have good roots and they tend to be found in the higher where you've got good establishment for the roots to take hold, especially in an area that gets hit with storms and hurricanes and all.
Right.
And so the oak trees, of those 40 oak trees, you know, that's something that we want to preserve for the cemetery to maintain. But I think it's a challenge when you're dealing with trees that are this large. Mm-hmm. In an Thibodaux is urban, and so on those 3 acres of land, the property is, for all practical purposes, in downtown Thibodaux, and so there's not a lot of green space outside of the cemetery. You know, so that's one of the challenges that we're dealing with is how these roots, when you look at the root system of these oak trees, they really spread mm-hmm. out. And that's one of the challenges of dealing with these trees and how they're impacting the graves in the area, because right. those roots do go out further, and the cemetery itself is surrounded on three sides by roads, and the oak trees are on the periphery, on the outside of the cemetery as well, so they kind of serve as a border. But they're beautiful, beautiful trees, And it's kind of neat to think that these things are, you know, 160 years right. old. They've seen a lot of history.
Oh, yeah. They've watched a lot of the folks that are buried there get buried.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine how those root systems would affect the actual grave sites, you know, after a while.
And on a like a somewhat side part of it, you know, I think while the graves really add to the uniqueness of it, I think the oak trees also add a certain beauty to the cemetery. Yeah. And for the organization and for the church to do what we can to kind of maintain the graves, the headstones and the grounds, and to cut the grass and weed eat and all that. We try and do different things. And years ago, there was, I think the church did this thing called a grave affair. And there's quite a number of notable people buried in the cemetery. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like a fun way of having people dress up in period costumes and took on the character of some of these people that are buried in the cemetery. We've got quite a number of historical figures that are buried in the cemetery, and the oak trees, I think, add to that, to mm-hmm. the, I can't think of the word right now, but add to
ambiance.
There you go.
Ambiance. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Diane. Yeah, exactly that. Adds to that ambiance, you know, cause you've got these massive oak trees and you've got the period costumes to kind of help explain the significance of the cemetery to St. John's Episcopal Church, but also the significance of the cemetery to the community and the city and all.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Now we have Theodore. Do you go by Theodore or do you go by Teddy? Theodore, what would you rather us call you today?
Either one.
So you have kind of taken charge, it sounds like, of helping to preserve and restore a lot of the monuments. And I'm sure working around all these trees and their root systems as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how you go about doing that and what kind of ends up taking priority? You know, what kind of monuments take priority over others when it comes to doing the preservation and restoration work?
Well, I've been working in the cemetery since 2013. I got a call from Mr. David Plater to come out and take a look, and I did. And we settled on some numbers and I started work. And it was just odd that the very first project that I worked on, a restoration project that I worked on, was to repair a vertical marble monument. It was a shaft of, it wasn't quite a pyramid, but it was a multi-sided but tapered structure that went up about maybe 15 feet in the air. And when I saw it was white marble, but you couldn't tell it was white marble because it was in three pieces and the pieces were covered with a black algae and what I call a biomass with algae and fungus and what have you. And they were on the two pieces were on the ground, and then you had a remaining piece of the shaft in place. And the thing, what was interesting about it is, that damage that was done to that marble structure was done by one of the oak trees. And
oh, no.
The name on the structure is Guyon. So,
oh no!
How about that? So, I was able to piece it together, and it's still intact. And I go through great efforts to use only those materials that the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training recommends. And I actually refer to them when I have a project, and I make sure that when I'm doing, and I also have a purveyor that I constantly refer to, Limeworks US. And they have been very kind. Their technical advisors give me advice on what I'm doing. For example, with that marble monument, I was planning on drilling holes in the center of the monument and using stainless steel dowels to hold that thing together. And I was advised, don't do that. Number one, because even with a tiny, tiny, say an eighth of an inch pilot hole, in the center and then go into a larger bit, there's a chance you could actually fracture the monument, the remaining pieces of marble, and have them have make a bigger mess than you already have. But I was advised to use what was called an injection grout, which was a lime-based product that that works extremely well. Just a very, I'm talking about a butter, like you butter the sides of the structure that you want to repair, and you put it back together, and it makes a tiny mortar joint, but it holds. I mean, it's been in Texas 2013, through whatever wind, storms, and what have you. But my work in that cemetery has been a great variety of projects. One of the more interesting things that I do is I clean the marble monuments. And the marble monuments had not been cleaned. I don't think they'd ever been cleaned, or they hadn't been cleaned in a very long time. So there's there are many, many layers of biomass. And I use a product. I don't know if I can use the name. I guess I'll use it. D2 Biological Solutions is my main product that I use, because of course you can't use bleach because of the damage that the bleach would do to the marble. And now the bleach would give you an instant cleaning, but the D2 takes a while to actually kick into gear. But once it does a very thorough job with no negative consequences. I also do masonry repairs, because one of the projects, the one that took the greatest amount of actual masonry repair work, was what we call Louisiana Scuddy. And we determined that the reason Louisiana Scuddy was in distress is because one of the oak tree roots had gotten under it and caused the front facade to be separated from the main building by 2 inches. And that was not good. And the only way to repair it, because of the nature of masonry, you can't just glue it back together. It has to be removed and reestablished the masonry bond from one section to the other. And I successfully did that to everybody's approval. And I've had several other projects in there that have been, I've done 25 restorations so far in that wow. Cemetery. And I work basically alone. What I do is I bring in a professional, very highest grade plasterer to come behind me, rather than me trying to do the plaster work, because I am not a plasterer. And it takes me too long to learn the plastering trade. So I bring this gentleman in from New Orleans. We are both commute from New Orleans, and we take care of the projects, the plastering needs. Then I come through and do the final coating with either lime wash or a potassium silicate paint.
Okay.
And just real quick, Thibodeau to New Orleans is about an hour, so that's about an hour drive.
That was going to be my question.
Yeah, it's about a 2-hour round trip.
So I was also very interested in hearing some of the stories about some of the long-term residents that you have buried in your cemetery. We always like to get those little snapshots of the community where these cemeteries are and who's there and why they're in that particular cemetery, and maybe why they were in the Thibodeau area in this case. So if you guys want to talk about a couple of those people, we would love to hear about them.
Well, let me give a little context first. We live in a rather complex cultural area where people, the first Europeans to settle our area were actually French Acadians who were being expelled. Some of them came directly in the 1760s, some were sent to France first and then arrived in the 1780s. And the Anglos, as we call ourselves, we white Protestants arrived closer to the 1790s and 1800s. and really didn't come in as settlers in the area until after the War of 1812. There was a need for a place for Protestants to be buried. And since the very beginning of St. John's, its occupants have been Protestants of all sects, also Catholics, some of whom were banned from their churches or who had somehow ended up in wedlock to a Protestant who insisted on being buried in a Protestant cemetery. Or in some cases, we have Jewish occupants there. Because southern towns in those days in the 19th century had quite important Jewish settlers who were in the trades and in the professions. And Antipodo was no exception to that. So the styles of the tombs tend to be more or less Protestant. They're not large tombs for the most part. The monuments that you see in our cemetery, most of them came from New Orleans because there wasn't anybody collecting in the early days. Nobody in our area had tombs which were readily available. So how can you get that to our area? Well, it had to come by steamboat up the river, Mississippi River, from New Orleans, and then enter Bayou Lafourche, which branches off of the river about 40 miles northeast of our town of Thibodaux, and then down along the bayou to finally get to Thibodaux. It was a two-day trip to bring something from New Orleans to Thibodaux. So they tended to be rather expensive, these tombs, so they also, because of that, tended to be simple. With a few exceptions, there are some large tombs which are more characteristic of the New Orleans cemeteries, where you have vaults that you bury people in. Ours tend to be smaller, and one person in a tomb or in a plot, I'd say. I don't know if I'm explaining this the way it should be explained, Teddy.
Oh, no, it's making perfect sense.
Yes, you're wrong.
I never knew, for example, even with the simpler monuments, that they were actually complicated in that you might have three different kinds of stone involved in the construction of those things. We didn't know that because these monuments were all covered with mildew, which Teddy has begun to clean off. So now we can see the monuments. We can see how beautiful they are, even in their simplicity. The people, as I mentioned, the people who were coming here were Protestants, and they came from different areas of the United States, beginning after the War of 1812. The city grew very slowly until about 1840. And then right about that time, we began to get more and more craftspeople moving into Thibodaux. Among those craftspeople were a couple of men from Uniontown, Pennsylvania, which is in the western part of Pennsylvania, Fayette County. These two guys hopped the boat, probably a small steamboat or maybe even a flatboat, and came down the Monongahela River, then onto the Ohio, then onto the Mississippi, and somehow figured out that Thibodaux was a good place to end up. I don't know how they... Perhaps they had friends or relatives living here before. One of these guys was named James Frost. And Frost's family had an inn and a bar tavern near Uniontown, right on the National Road. Has anybody heard of that?
I don't think I have.
It was an established road that that was designed in the late 18 teens and 20s to connect Baltimore to Indiana. Before that, they had just wagon roads, and this road, this national road, which is one of the first federal roads, went right through this western part of Pennsylvania on its way into the Ohio Valley. So Frost and a friend named Morgan Springer were both master carpenters. They had grown up in an area where there was a lot of stonework and masonry work and very complex carpentry like grist mills and that kind of thing. They really knew their stuff. When they get to Thibodeau, there was an instant demand for their services. James Frost became a very successful businessman and builder in Thibodeau. He ended up buying 2 acres of land near the downtown area and had his own shop. He had made his own pieces of architectural carpentry. And then suddenly in 1853, Thibodeau was struck by an epidemic of yellow fever. James Frost died in October of 1853, among about 300 people in Thibodeau, and the town only had at that time about 1,200 people. So a quarter of the town at least was wiped out within a couple of months, and Frost was among them. So his tomb is a box tomb that is very much resembling the Roman burial crypts. Teddy, you can elaborate on that because you're trained in architecture. Would you do that for me?
Yeah, it's a sarcophagus-looking structure, very plain, and in fact, there's a pair of them. They're a matched pair, one right next to the other. And I became friends with, was that his grandson or his son?
His great grandson.
He and I became friends. There were two things that I noticed about the St. John's Episcopal Cemetery. One is I cannot justify on an environmental level like we do in New Orleans the above ground burials. In New Orleans, they bury above ground, or one of the reasons is for environmental reasons, because especially in the 1850s and until we came up with a decent subsurface drainage system, there were times when they would have heavy rain and the water table would be so high that tombs would literally pop out of the ground. We experienced that during hurricane season in some of the low-lying areas. But in Thibodeau, I checked my geological information on my phone, and they got 15 to 20 feet above sea level. In some cases, they're even higher than that. So there's no particular reason why, other than stylistic reasons for burying above ground. Right. The second thing is when I was working on the Louisiana Scuddy project, that's the only one where I physically had to open the face of an above ground structure and replace the entire front facade and reconnect it to the remaining of the building. I noticed there was a cast iron casket in that structure. And I started doing some research, and I thought maybe it was all about vanity, about, you know, once you put the casket in the tomb, nobody would know. I mean, after people die. But before then, when you go to the funeral and you see a cast iron tomb, you say, "Oh God, that guy must have been doing really well. His family was doing well." But then I discovered, I dig a little deeper, and I discovered that in the 1850s, as a result of those communicable diseases that were being spread, it was determined that the cast iron casket, which was hermetically sealed, was actually a boon to public health. Has anybody ever heard anything about that?
I have not, but that's an interesting thought. It kind of makes sense.
The one thing I was thinking of was body snatching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It would be a lot harder to snatch a body out of a cast iron casket than a wooden one.
And Teddy, if I could comment to your first question about the environmental impact or the question of above ground tombs, and this kind of comes a little bit from speaking with David a couple of days ago, and then also just knowledge of the area and all, and the relationship with the cemetery when we talk about people buried in the cemetery. St. John's is not far at all from the bayou. Elevation right now around Thibodeau in St. John's, I would say, is anywhere from maybe 11 to 13 feet above sea level. So it's not very high. And one of the people buried in the cemetery goes by the name of John Lovell, L-O-V-E-L-L. John Lovell, John A. Lovell, was a surveyor. And I teach land surveying at Nicholls State University. And so John Lovell was a surveyor way back in the day, in the early 1900s. And he amassed a great record of downtown Thibodeau, of the area. And talking with David just the other day, finding about, these early drainage records, if you look at how the geology of a coastal area works over a river, you'll have the coarser sediments are closer to the bayou. And as you get further away from the bayou, you get the backwater, you get more flooding further and further away. So as you get, St. John's is on the west bank of Bayou Lafourche, like I said, maybe 3/4 of a mile away from the, it's not far at all from the bayou at all. And back in the day, before the flood projects or the drainage efforts that were put by the city nowadays, maybe in the early 1900s, there was a lot of flooding in that area. And John Lovell, the surveyor, has this huge collection that has now been his plats and his field books and all of his records have been donated to the Nicholls Archives. So you've got this great archival record of early mapping efforts of Thibodeau. The man that created all that's buried here in St. John's. And I think that does help explain a little bit of the environmental factors of why, even though it is, we do have some elevation, why we still need to have some graves buried above ground in the above ground tombs. And we still, with those oaks, we still have some flooding issues, but that's more of a current drainage issue now of all the leaves that come off an oak tree during those changing seasons.
Right.
And we don't have enough squirrels to eat all the acorns off the ground.
We'll send you some bears.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. If we can get like a Yogi Bear, maybe. But
they came up the Cane River and not the Cane River as it exists today, but the Cane River of old, where it went all the way up from New Orleans. They would come on these steamboats and flat steam operated vessels that would go up with shallow draft. And he carried bricks and whatever it needed to build these this tomb. And I was just curious.
Well, and
brings up a question of how the materials were assembled for construction of the 19th century tombs, and Teddy and John can elaborate on this, but you have typically, for example, you have to find bricks, you've got to get your mortar somewhere, and then if you want to have something fancy like an ornament or a cross, it wasn't possible to find one there. You had to go to New Orleans to get that. But the other stuff, early on at least, the other stuff was all made in the local area. And so would you guys like to talk a little bit about how that was done?
I can't speak about how the bricks were made in the local area, but looking at the bricks of, you know, how they're related to some of the individuals that are buried, I know that there were some individuals from, I think it was Last Island, which was hit by a hurricane in the 1800s. And I think it's unnamed individuals that are buried in that particular crypt, but it was there. It's with the bricks, and the area isn't trying to get bricks into the area. As David's saying, you've got to go, if you look at the geography of the area, you have to go up the river, up the Mississippi River, and then down the bayou to bring the bricks to the area, or as what Teddy was saying, getting on a paddle wheel and a steamboat to bring all these resources up for unnamed individuals that are buried. And you know, the brickwork is not a cheap resource to have buried to have constructed that goes with the area.
And going along with that, could be even more limiting, not the bricks, but the mortar. Where are you going to find lime-based mortar? Because that's what they found. So you know what they did? They used oyster shell mortar. So they took oyster shells and they processed them. I've seen this done. I've been to symposiums in many locales and seen this actually done. It's amazing to watch this done. And that was actually taught to the locals by the American Indians, because that's what they were doing. They figured out, well, you have to, it's a calcium carbonate base. That's what it is. And calcium carbonate is the same base as concrete. Portland cement is, when you go back to the basics, that's what it is. It's calcium carbonate. And but you can find it in oyster shells, in clam shells, in a number of different sources. But that's the real killer, is where do you get, yes, the bricks. And oftentimes the bricks, for example, when I was working at Melrose, the bricks that we used to build the African house was built in 1800. That brick was made on site. And that brick was called a low-fired brick, because the heat source was wood. And you could only get a certain amount of temperature out of wood, so the bricks were not that durable. And so there were, now what I found extremely interesting and really kind of blew my mind. I was, when I worked on that tomb in Melrose, well, right outside of Melrose, it's in the cemetery behind the St. Augustine Catholic Church, which is in a place called Natchez, Louisiana. The brick that was used looked like the brick we refer to here as the North Lake brick. What that means is the clays were very different from the clays south of Lake Pontchartrain, because there are two completely different geological areas from characteristics from North Lake to South Lake. And the clays on the North Lake side were much more amenable to being a durable brick. All of the soft red bricks or the low-fired bricks were all supposed to be plastered. They were not supposed to be exposed. People like to expose soft red brick right now because they like the colors and the variation. It's got a nice patina. But that's not the way it was originally designed. That brick was supposed to always be plastered, because the folks who originally used them knew that that brick was not a very durable brick and could not handle exposure to environmental influences like wind and pounding rain and such. But the bricks from the North Lake, and that guy Salmon was the one who really Salmon, and that's the fellow. He was a Swiss guy who started, who really got into that business, and that was how he made his fortune in that whole area around Slidell. And right now, St. Joe, Louisiana, that's where the St. Joe brick, the same brick. But it was that brick was the brick I found in Natchitoches. And I said, oh my God, they brought all these bricks up from Nelson. Can I find that the clays in that part of the state are the same clays that they use that you find in the North Lake area?
That is really telling us what is part of our big problem in St. John's Episcopal Cemetery, that this soft brick has been so subject to weathering and to misrepair over the years. People have made repairs to their tombs, but it's been done incorrectly because they're using mm-hmm. materials to repair the tombs that they shouldn't be using.
Yes, they use important cement-based mortar in combination with those brick, with those low-fired brick. What it does, the original system called for the brick, the mortar to be what's called sacrificial. The mortar was to be softer and more porous and than the brick, so that yes, moisture would get in, but it would come out through the mortar, not through the brick. When you use the inappropriate mortar to build a structure with that soft red brick, what happens over time is because the Portland cement-based mortar is basically waterproof. It doesn't allow for percolation. It doesn't allow for moisture to get through. Not in the way that the lime-based mortar does. And what happens is the moisture is going to escape. So what it does is it moves through the face of the brick. And eventually it pushes the face of the brick off because that face of that brick is not very durable. That's when you see that erosion of the brick. The other thing they do is they'll use Portland cement-based plaster over the structure, and it literally causes the brick inside to melt. Mm. The other thing they do, there are three things they do wrong, is they use a latex or a rubber-based paint. You're supposed to allow that brick to breathe. It's got to breathe, meaning the moisture that comes in must escape, again, through the mortar. And if you cut off all of those sources, one of the things that happens, especially if you call yourself repointing with Portland cement-based mortar, and if there's a lime-based mortar behind it, and you don't allow the lime-based mortar to come in contact with moisture, the lime-based mortar becomes a powder. And it loses its structural integrity. That's what I have found over time. But what I've found, if you pluck that offending mortar out, and all you got to do is re-dampen that lime-based mortar, it comes to life like you would not believe. It's like a living creature. It is amazing.
We need to train about 1,000 Teddy Pierres.
Yeah.
there's an incredible lack of professional restorers in our area, and we've been so lucky to have Teddy, but what are we doing in the future? What are we going to do to keep our cemetery?
You're going to have to some yeah. younger ones to take
on. I was
going to
say, I think that should be a trade school option.
Yeah.
Start training some people up.
Since I do restoration at our cemetery up here, I have some questions for you guys. After you use the D2, how long do you find that the stone stays clean? Or is it something you have to do like every couple years or so?
Remember, we're in a very damp climate and mildew loves our area. So it doesn't last very long, maybe a year or two, three, okay. Maybe, Teddy?
Maybe 3 years. We could stretch it to about 3 years. But even at the end of 3 years, if all you do is take the D2, and you can cut it 50-50, that's what I usually do.
Right.
And you cut it and just spray it on and leave it there. That's all you got to do.
Yes, because some of our trees have this fungus and the stones are black. So we have people that come out and volunteer to wash them. And they're not treated because a lot of them are granite, so it washes very easy. But usually within a year, maybe, they're back. So I'm wondering if putting a D2 on them will have them last longer.
Jason Church is the national expert as it relates to the United States Park Service. He is the cemetery restoration expert out of Natchitoches, Louisiana. That's the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. I was talking to Jason. They're doing a project over at Evergreen, and I needed to go out there for a reason. And he and I were chatting, and I said, Jason, I encountered this black algae. I'm calling it a black algae because I don't know the exact name of it, and I really would like to know what it is. And I said, man, it's giving me the blues. It took me 2 months to get this stuff off. And I'm talking about the two monuments that are now sparkling white, Mr. Plater. I forget the names on the doggone things. But anyway, they were black, and they were now white. They're now white marble. But it took me 2 months, and I had to get in there and not only apply the D2, but I had to scrub it with a Tampico brush, not a heavy brush, but a natural fiber brush. Tampico is a
right.
natural fiber, and I really like it.
Yep.
And so
yeah.
I had to do that. I did that at least 6 times to get that thing. But once I got it moving, it began to show signs that I was defeating it. And he told me that one of the things D2 is doing is they are ramping up their product. They're going to come out with a D2 sort of one of a D2 201 or whatever, which is it's got more of the active ingredient in it than the standard D2. And I hope they don't up the price by another 50%, because that stuff is expensive. It's cost me $65 a gallon. That's it. I cut it 50-50. Except when I have a real tough one, I put it on straight.
We're talking about the Limeworks. Do you get that, the injection grout? Did you buy that from Cathedral Stone?
They probably got a similar product.
Okay.
There's Cathedral Stone. There's that group out of Chicago is called...
U.S. Heritage. I took training from U.S. Heritage.
Fantastic. They are fantastic.
Yes. Okay.
I really love that guy from their technical advisor, technical assistant. Man, I talk to that guy and I share him what I'm doing. Excuse me, I send him photographs and he gives me advice. I just love it. I love it.
Yeah, they're good people. Yeah, we went out to Chicago a few years ago. Well, it's more than a few years ago, like 10 years ago. And
in fact,
yeah.
That's where I got the injection grout from. It wasn't from Limeworks. I got it from
them. Heritage. Okay.
I got it from them because, again, I was going over my process that I was planning to use on that Guyon monument restoration. I was going to drill the holes. He said, oh, no, don't you do that. He said, oh, man, no. He said, and then he gave me step-by-step what I should do. I did it, and it worked.
Yeah, we fixed some stones with that as well too. And out of curiosity, how do you fund your projects? So you're doing them yourselves. So it's not like you're technically having to pay an expert to come in.
Well, Diane, this is the finding the money is the job of St. John's Episcopal Church and or these. St. John's Historic Cemetery Association, of which I was chairman until this year. But we have to go out and tap ourselves or find foundations or companies. And it's difficult work sometimes.
Yeah, because our cemetery is a city-owned cemetery, and we're 220 acres. So, but we're not city funded.
Wow.
So, you don't get any money from the city. So we raise any cemetery funding we do, we raise through like the events such as the walking tour and stuff. So I just was curious how invested your community is in your cemetery.
Well, I think they're interested, but it's hard just to get the squeeze the orange every year.
Yeah.
And our economy, it depends on how the local economy is going.
Right.
We're not able to get too much help from foundations outside of our region. We haven't been able to find good sources, like John Deere Corporation has a factory in Thibodaux, but they have a separate foundation and they've not been receptive to entreaties for funding for our cemetery.
Yeah. So, and then do you guys have volunteers that come in and do work projects, or since it's so specific, you guys just pretty much do them yourselves?
Well,
the restoration.
The congregation and others, we've been able to get help from some Mormons who are in service in our area. And we have work days on Saturdays twice a year, and the congregation gathers and works in the cemetery and around the church as well, pulling weeds and doing that kind of stuff.
But
none of us is well trained enough to know what to do what Teddy has to do, which is to take a cracked and crumbling tomb and put it back together. That's what's really a challenge. In fact, when we have hurricanes occasionally, the last one that really did damage in Thibodaux was about 13 years ago. And it caused tree limbs to fall on the tombs and just did a mess. So that really opened our eyes about what we needed to do. And I think it's from that point that more and more effort has begun to publicize our cemetery and show how historic it is. And it's a slow thing.
And that kind of with those oak trees, you know, we're trying to protect not just everyone that's permanently staying there, but also the people that are coming to visit because of the challenges of these storms that do come in. They've got the heavy winds. And these trees, as old as they are, you know, the volunteers, we're doing a lot of the cleanup, but we're not the professionals to take down.
Take down trees.
Well, and I did notice on your website, on the Cemetery Association's website, there is a link for if anybody's interested, especially if you live in the Thibodaux area, where you can make donations to help support the funding efforts of all this restoration and preservation work, because it is really expensive. And I know a lot of cemeteries around the country run into the same problem of people want to see them restored and preserved and kept up, but it costs a lot of money. So you either need to have corporations who are willing to put some of their money into these cemeteries, which, as David said, is really hard to get them on board with, or you need a lot of individuals that are willing to make annual contributions or host fundraisers on a regular basis to bring in the funding to help with those types of efforts, because it all gets very expensive really fast, especially when you need to bring in, you know, specialists like Teddy and professional landscapers and things like that to help with all of that. Because as those of us who just volunteer our time, a lot of us are limited to how much we can actually do.
And I think on the website also is just kind of like a little biography about, you know, we didn't mention nearly all the people that are buried out there that really adds the uniqueness of the cemetery, as well as some history of the town. You know, anybody that's doing genealogy is always going to be interested in who's buried, and kind of getting to the fundraiser thing. You know, I mentioned it earlier, you know, we did this grave affair thing, and it was kind of a fun little thing to do where everybody dresses up. And that's something I think, you know, Diane, I don't know, for a 200 acre, that's a large cemetery.
But we've done it. We did half of the cemetery.
Yeah, it's, but trying to, you got to be, I think you got to think outside the box to try and bring in some funds to help preserve, you know, the history and the landscape and the structures.
That's our biggest fundraiser, was the walking tour, which I've done, I did for 20 years. So it's like, well, we're going on to something new this fall.
Yes,
we're gonna try a whole new experience this fall. I think it'll be a lot of fun for the Evergreen Cemetery there in Colorado Springs. But one of the things that our podcast really wants to do is actually start working on helping with some of these preservation efforts, because for Diane and I personally, cemeteries are definitely near and dear to our heart, and preserving the stories of who's buried in these cemeteries. And again, our goal has always been, especially the stories of the everyday people, the ones that they might've been somewhat well-known in their own communities or whatever, but outside of that, you know, nobody's heard of them, nobody knows. And we wanna make sure those stories get out there. And so part of the podcast is to help present all of that information and present all of these cemeteries that are all over the US, and we've even done some worldwide ones, and that's always fun too. But to make people aware that they're there. I know a lot of people are two mindsets. They're either like us, all of us here, and to, you know, that are excited about a cemetery and we want to see them preserved and we want to do the work, or they're creeped out and can't understand why so many of us like to spend time in them.
And it's depressing. Yeah,
they think of them as depressing. And I find most cemeteries are not depressing, but if you haven't spent a lot of time in them, or if you have associations with death that are very negative, a cemetery is a hard place to get on board with as far as being a pleasant place to be. So our goal is to make people more aware of them. Hopefully more people are, you know, finding these episodes. And we're not the only cemetery podcast out there. There's several others that are very good that are still on board with telling the stories and trying to get the awareness to help communities take care of their cemeteries. And I think for a lot of people too, or at least things I've come across, I don't think people always know who runs a cemetery or how a lot of cemeteries are run. Some are city owned, like Diane said, Evergreen is, but it's city owned, but not funded by the city. So they go through their association to raise money. You guys are on a church property. You're technically part of the church, but you guys end up raising all your own funds. And that's what a lot of cemeteries are. There's not that many, or at least not the many that I've been aware of, that get a lot of funds from the cities or the communities where they live. So that all has to come from
the
people in the communities. Yeah. So hopefully, Thibodaux area listeners, if you didn't know much about St. John's, hopefully this lights your fire and makes you want to go visit. I definitely, if I were in Louisiana, would make a pit stop there to go visit you guys, because looking at the pictures, it's a gorgeous,
beautiful cemetery.
Place to be. And
please come. We'd love to have you.
We would love to come. Well, we would like to thank.
I have one comment that I'd like to share with you, because I thought it was so profound when I heard it. I was attending a symposium with Jason Church, which Jason Church was leading. And when he opened it, he said something that has really stuck with me. I wish I could claim these words as my own. He said, if you look at the Western cemetery dating from about the 1830s on to about the 1950s, they are the largest sculpture garden in any community. And I have to agree with him. When I'm in St. John's, that's exactly what I'm experiencing. And I'm looking around at these various shapes and textures and interpretations and what have you. There's some very interesting pieces of funerary art in that cemetery.
And craftwork that isn't done anymore.
That's correct. That is correct. Yes, ma'am. Antique. That's what I love about it.
Yes, it makes cemeteries just, they're special places. And so we want to make sure people know about them and they care about them and want to see them continue. However, that I was going to say see him live, but that's probably the wrong term to use when you're referring to cemeteries.
You know, one of the problems is that families who are buried in the cemetery have disappeared. And so when we are raising money or doing a function, we try to contact family members and it's impossible. And I wish there, thankfully, the internet has allowed us to do a little better job of that lately, but still getting people who live in California who used to live in Thibodeau to support Thibodeau anymore is very difficult. You probably run into that all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We have been so pleased to have you, and it was nice to hear all about St. John's. And for our listeners, we will have some pictures posted on all the social media and on our website and everything, so you can get a sort of sense of it. But yes, if you live in the Thibodeau area or New Orleans, or, you know, you're not far, I don't know if people are like me, I will drive a couple of hours to go see a cemetery, no big deal. So definitely go give this cemetery a look and help give it some love. And if you are nearby and can volunteer and help with cleanups on a regular basis, and or even research for, you know, those other tombs that are in there. Research is always handy. So if you're somebody who loves to do research and want to find out stories and have access to information, definitely look St. John's up and help them out.
Thank you all for having us. And I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Nice meeting y'all. Y'all take care.
We are so glad that you chose to once again join us for another episode of the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery. If you are new here and would like to listen to our other episodes, you can find them on our website, theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram at The Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery and on Twitter at OrdExtraSim. We would also very much appreciate it if you would consider leaving us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcast or even on our website. We love hearing from you, and we welcome your feedback.
Thank you. Until we meet again.